From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Christmas weekend might give you more time to go to the movies. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the stars of two new films. Forrest Whitaker plays a fashion designer in Ready to Wear, Robert Altman's satire of the French fashion world. Whitaker also portrayed jazz great Charlie Parker in Bird. In The Crying Game, he played the soldier kidnapped by the IRA. In the new film Little Women, Gabriel Byrne plays the professor who Joe falls in love with. Byrne starred in the gangster film Miller's Crossing and produced In the Name of the Father. Also today, music critic Milo Miles has some suggestions for those R&B fans on your Christmas list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A bomb exploded in a New York City subway car today, injuring at least 31 people, 4 critically. There have been no deaths. The blast caused havoc in Lower Manhattan. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
The explosion occurred at 1:30 this afternoon near the Wall Street area in a train going south as it stopped at the Fulton Street station. Witnesses described people on the ground rolling around. It was mayhem, said one. It was chaos. One woman came running out, her hair, her jacket, and her pants on fire. Passersby knocked her to the ground, swatting her with jackets and packages to get the flames out. Police say the explosion was caused by an incendiary device that may have been held in a passenger's lap. There were early reports that a second bomb was discovered, but police now say these reports were erroneous. Most of the injured have been taken to hospitals. I'm Margo Adler in New York.
North Korea says it will return the body of U.S. helicopter pilot David Heilman to U.S. officials tonight. Congressman Bill Richardson, who's been in North Korea, is expected to accompany Heilman's body. The North has also indicated that it will soon return surviving pilot Bobby Hall to U.S. hands. There's hope that Hall will be released by Christmas. The men were piloting a helicopter that went down in North Korea last Saturday. The U.S. says the men were lost, perhaps because of a heavy snowstorm that covered up landmarks. The United States may have to speed up its relocation of Cubans who are now in refugee camps in Panama. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
The Panamanian Foreign Ministry has notified the Clinton administration that all Cuban refugees will have to be out of the country no later than March 3rd. Speaking to reporters as he left the National Assembly, where he had answered questions on the status of the refugees, Mr. Gabriel Luis Galindo insisted that the U.S. government must take the necessary steps to ensure that all the refugees are removed in the next 60 days. The Panamanian authorities are worried that violence can again erupt in the camps maintained by the United States Southern Command. Panama has said that it will not extend the agreement that granted safe haven to more than 8,400 Cuban refugees beyond the expiration date. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
The spokesman for Italy's prime minister says Silvio Berlusconi is likely to resign tomorrow. He's facing a vote of no confidence by the Italian parliament. He's warned the lawmakers that if he loses the vote, he'll immediately dissolve parliament and call for snap elections. A consumer group says thousands of American kids die needlessly each year. Citizen Action has released a study saying the deaths of 23,000 children every year are preventable. The group says premature delivery of babies accounts for the largest number of preventable deaths. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 37 points at 3,804. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Former Secretary of State Dean Rusk has died at his home in Athens, Georgia. He was 85. The University of Georgia Medical Center says he died of congestive heart failure. Melinda Weir of member station WUGA reports from Athens.
Rusk was the United States' top diplomat during much of the 1960s. He served from 1961 to 1969 under President John F. Kennedy and President Lyndon Johnson. In his 8-year term in the cabinet, Rusk presided over 4 major global events: the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the signing of a nuclear non-proliferation treaty with the Soviet Union, and the Vietnam War. Rusk retired in 1970 to an honored professor's chair at the University of Georgia Law School in Athens. He taught until 1984. Rusk had been in declining health for several years. For National Public Radio, I'm Melinda Weir in Athens, Georgia.
Incoming House Speaker Newt Gingrich is reportedly getting a security detail. The New York Daily News says the arrangements include round-the-clock armed plainclothes bodyguards, uniformed officers outside his offices, and an armored limo driver with police radios. The paper says Gingrich aides believe death threats against the Georgia Republicans have been increasingly on the rise. The New Jersey Supreme Court says shopping malls in the state must allow free speech. The court says large malls must let groups pass out leaflets talking about political or social issues. Again, our top story, a bomb exploded in a New York City subway car today, injuring 31 people. Four of them have been critically hurt. There were no deaths. The scene has been described as chaotic. The FBI has now joined the investigation now that the incident has shown to be a bomb blast. Authorities now discount an earlier report that said a second bomb was found aboard the train. Police now say no second device was found. The blast occurred about a mile from the World Trade Center, the site of a terrorist bombing 2 years ago. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Forrest Whitaker, co-stars in Ready to Wear, Robert Altman's satire of the French fashion world, which opens Christmas Day. Whitaker made his film debut in Fast Times at Ridgemont High and co-starred in Platoon and Good Morning Vietnam. He portrayed jazz genius Charlie Parker in Bird and played the soldier kidnapped by the IRA in The Crying Game. More recently, he was featured in Jason's Lyric. Before we hear how he went from high school football star to film star, let's find out about his new role in Ready to Wear. He plays a fashion designer who's having an affair with a rival designer.
He is a designer who does recycled clothes, recouped clothes, takes old things and turns them into new things, redesigns them, restructures them. He wants to keep his clothes affordable, and he likes to keep a flavor of the street and flavor of life in his stuff.
What did Robert Altman tell you to prepare you for his improvisational approach to shooting the film?
Not really much. I mean, he said that the script was skeletal, and if I had any thoughts and different ideas that, you know, we should talk about them, and then we just have some fun. That was basically what he said.
The first time I really noticed you in a movie, it was in The Color of Money, which was the sequel to The Hustler that Martin Scorsese directed. It starred Paul Newman as the former hustler, and you played the hustler who hustles Paul Newman. And in that scene, you had such an interesting kind of wild look on your face. It was something in your eyes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought truly that you were the most memorable part of the film. When the film ended, it was really like that scene and your face that I thought about. How did you get the part? Was that your first screen role?
It wasn't my first, but I guess it was one of the first roles of any length. I had done Fast Times at Ridgemont High first.
Oh, right.
I played a football player in that. And then that film, The Color of Money, they called me and asked me if I'd be willing to fly myself into Chicago and audition for Martin Scorsese. And they told me that would be in about 2 weeks or so. And so I said, cool, I'll do that. And so I just went, because I wasn't a very good pool player, so I just went and hung out for a couple of weeks in the pool halls and stuff. And I was playing pool all day, you know, 8 hours a day almost. You know, it was a pretty full job. And I was just watching the hustlers that were there and hanging out with them and playing and playing. So actually by the time I got to Chicago, when I got there, I was playing pool really well. And the first thing I did was go to a pool hall before I even met with them, and I was playing that night. And I went in the next day, and before I auditioned for the role, he wanted me to play pool. So I played pool with the nine-ball champion of the world at the time. And I guess he was trying to work something out with Scorsese about the balls, you know, so he wanted us to play eight-ball. You know, I guess he was trying to convince him to play eight-ball in some scenes, and which was lucky for me. It was fortunate for me because I felt really cocky by that time about my pool playing. But to play eight-ball after playing nine-ball for 2 weeks straight was, like, so simple. You know, I mean, it was like I was laughing and just shooting, turning my back to the table, and the balls are just falling. I almost beat him because I didn't miss a shot, you know. And I missed one shot, and then he beat me.
So this was like your big 4 minutes on the screen, right? And I know for some actors, when they have like a small part in a big movie, they worry that they might overdo it in that part, you know, because you want people, this is like your 4 minutes on screen or your 1 minute on screen, and you want everybody to notice you and you want to be great. But if you work too hard about being great, you might overdo it. Were you worried about that at all?
I never worry about that. I always work too hard. You know, I mean, I figure I work too hard and then I come in. But, I mean, when I went to the pool hall when I first got to Chicago, I went and there were people were playing it. Everybody looked like they couldn't play to me. Everybody looked like they couldn't play because I had been playing so hard, you know. So by the time I played, it was like natural for me. It was easy because I worked so hard at it. You know, if I hadn't worked so hard at it, it wouldn't have been, it would have been work for me. It wasn't. It was like a game. I wouldn't have been able to turn my back or shoot a shot and like turn away and start walking or laughing about it and make the sound of it hitting the thing, you know, when I auditioned for Scorsese, because I wouldn't have worked hard enough to know that that was going to go in. I knew that they were going to go in. I had no question that if I made a shot, it was going to go in. You know, I didn't have any question at all.
You know. Let me ask you about what may be your best known film, or I should say your best known part in a film. I'm thinking of The Crying Game, where you play somebody who's kidnapped by the IRA, and your girlfriend in the movie is the girl whose secret was The Crying Game's big secret. Were you surprised what a fuss was made over keeping the secret?
Yeah, I was surprised. I wasn't surprised at first. I thought that in the beginning that it was intriguing, probably, for people to think there's a secret. You know, everybody wants to know what's the end of a secret. But then it became a certain point for me, you know, absurd, you know. But, you know, it's just my opinion, you know. I just thought, I mean, the film did so well, so it's difficult for me to say that, but I felt what succeeded financially was a moral dilemma, because it was, marketing-wise, it did well. But I thought a film that was basically about trying to say that you need to look inside of who people are and look at what people are, you know, for who they are in their heart and in their soul. You know, by the time the Academy Awards were rolling around and all that stuff, and there's still, like, this guy who's playing, you know, a transvestite in the film is still being hidden to that degree. I thought he could have made a lot of really powerful and poignant and important statements, so I thought it was a missed opportunity in the respects of the social issues.
Let me ask you about a specific scene in The Crying Game. After you're kidnapped by the IRA, they put, I forget whether it's a sheet or a sack over your face so that you can't see who your kidnappers are, so you won't be able to identify them if you live through the experience. And there's a scene where Stephen Ray is assigned to watch you, and you've got that sack over your head, and he takes it off so that you can eat and breathe, because you're having a lot of trouble breathing.
Right.
And the look on your face is just terrific when the hood comes off. First of all, you're all wet because it's been hard to breathe and you're kind of choking. And you look both disoriented and scared, and you're angry too. And I guess I'm wondering what you were thinking about to get that expression on your face at the moment that the hood was taken off.
And I mean, I don't know exactly what I was thinking at that moment. I guess, I obviously I was, the character was desperate, and under the hood, I mean, it was hot, and it was not as difficult to breathe as my mind would make it difficult for me to breathe, you know. And I guess I was so desperate to get a chance to connect. It was my only chance, you know. And that hood for me was kind of, I always felt it was kind of metaphoric, you know, for every time it was what I needed to, if I can get him to take the hood off, then maybe I can get him to take this off, and maybe he has to look at me as a human being. That's why I say that the movie is about that, you know, and the whole thing is like, you know, he's not looking at me, and the more he has to look at me, the more I become personal to him, and I'm a person, you know, and that's what, it was my first glimpse or my first breath of air to get a chance to live, you know, and for him to see me, you know. I need him to look at me, you know. I need him to see who I am, and then maybe I have a chance.
Forrest Whitaker is my guest, and he co-stars in Robert Altman's new movie, Ready to Wear. You grew up in Los Angeles. Were you anywhere near the showbiz parts of L.A.?
No, I didn't know anything about the film industry when I grew up. I mean, it wasn't until maybe at the end of my high school years that I started thinking about it. And I wasn't thinking about film, you know. It was music. Originally, I mean, I didn't go to a lot of films when I was a kid. I didn't really do that. You know, we went to drive-ins every once in a while, you know, my family. I didn't go to a walk-in theater or what do you call it? I don't know. It's the difference between a movie theater. I mean, no, it's just a movie theater. We call it a walk-in theater until I was maybe in high school. You know,
wow.
I didn't do that, you know, so I don't really, it's a whole other thing, you know, for me. And we went to drive-ins because, you know, kids get in free in drive-ins, you know. So, and that's when we went, and we went every once in a while.
What kind of neighborhoods did you grow up in?
When I moved to L.A., my parents moved to South Central L.A., and then my parents moved to Carson, and they still live in Carson.
What is Carson?
It's right next to Compton, in Carson-Compton line.
I read that you went to high school in a pretty affluent white neighborhood. How did you get to that school?
Well, my mom's a teacher, and I was supposed to go to Compton High, and Compton's predominantly black neighborhood. Now it's partly Hispanic. The high school there is, you know, they didn't give them much funding. I went to a public school. I went to Palisades High, which is by the beach, by Malibu, by, you know. It was a public school, but there's a very big difference between the way the things that are offered at Palisades High and the things that are offered at Compton High, you know. People who graduated from Compton High with a straight-A average couldn't even get accepted into universities and stuff because they couldn't pass the SATs and stuff like that. Not their fault, it's just the way they were taught and things they were offered. You know, there are schools that they just have their opportunities. It's little things. We didn't have no, I mean, computer classes and accelerated classes, French, Spanish, and then the other languages and, you know, auditoriums. It just was different, you know. It wasn't, those opportunities were not there. Most of my friends who went there are, at best, most of them are working at, you know, management at like a market, you know. Not to say that, you know, I don't know how I would have been if I went to that school. My mother and my father chose that I didn't go there. So I went to Palisades High using my cousin's address, which was in another neighborhood that was being bused into Palisades. They didn't live in Palisades as well. And I went to school there. It took me about at least an hour a day to get to school, maybe an hour and a half.
That's a really long time.
It was, it was a choice that my family made. They made that choice in junior high school, actually.
Were you interested in getting a good education when you went to Palisades High? Did you care about school?
I was always a straight-A student, so it didn't really matter. I mean, at Palisades, it was the same. You know, I mean, I was always somebody who studied and read, you know, even since I was a little babe, maybe because of my mom. So when she sent me there, it was the same. When I was at the other school, I was studying. Maybe the educational opportunities were different, and the teaching staff was different, you know what I mean, and the opportunities. And the people who would come in as your role models and stuff, people, like, who would come in and, like, say, oh, you know, you can do this and you can do that, or why don't you join us here? Maybe they didn't come to that school, to my other school, but I always excelled in school, so it was, you know, that was a choice.
Now, I understand you got both a football scholarship and a singing scholarship when you went to college. What kind of singing were you doing?
I was singing classical voice. I was singing, at Palisades, I started singing in the choir, and we were singing Italian art songs and stuff like that. You know, so I got a scholarship, you know, to the USC Music Conservatory to study sing opera. So it was a way to go to school. Originally, out of high school, I got a football scholarship. So, and then I auditioned or sang for them, and they gave me a music scholarship, and then I got an acting scholarship. And that's the way it kind of went.
But did people in football understand why you'd be interested in art song and vice versa?
No, they laughed. But I mean, but they still liked me. It couldn't mess with me because I was one of the best players on the team. I was like captain. I was like all city. You know, I was, you know, it can't like mess with me because all the colleges were recruiting me.
Well, you're in pre-production now to direct Waiting to Exhale, mm-hmm. which is adapted from the Terry McMillan novel,
yeah.
which was a bestseller. It seems that for a lot of actors, acting has almost become a stepping stone to directing. And the assumption seems to be now that if you act, you should ultimately want to direct. Do you really want to continue directing? Is that something you love to do, or is it just kind of happening, and are you ambivalent about it?
I like directing much more than I like to act.
Why?
It's much more enjoyable for me. It feels more complete. I like this, to tell stories in that way, you know. I like that. I enjoy getting a chance to try to allow people to express their themselves, you know, clearly from their spirit, you know, and to create the right environment, the movement, the color, the sound, the thought, you know. It's much more complete for me, you know. Some actors direct and they don't like it afterwards, you know. I directed one film and I loved it. So I was trying to decide what to direct, and then this is one of the projects that was brought to me, and when I met with them, and then I decided that this would be a good one to do.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Forest Whitaker co-stars in the new film Ready to Wear. It opens Christmas Day. Coming up, some R&B gift suggestions from music critic Milo Miles. This is Fresh Air. For this Christmas season, music critic Milo Miles has two suggestions for CD presents that he guarantees will endure way past Christmas. I never met a girl who makes me feel the way that you do. You're all right. Whenever I'm asked who makes my dreams real, I say that you do. You're out of sight. So be fine.
Ah, sweet mystery of box sets at Christmas time. I can just hear Santa's little elves conspiring together.
What overwrought monstrosity shall we drop on the helpless consumers this year?
How about a cube of Aerosmith? Or wait, another Everly Brothers. No, I got it. Jimmy Buffett.
Well, box sets are supposed to be extravagances, more likely something you would give than buy for yourself. But let's consider the R&B fans in your life, okay? There's some durable finds out there for them.
Ain't no words to this song. You just dance and hum along. Ain't no words to this song. You just dance and hum along.
The Can't Miss Gift is a definitive anthology from a group that's a strong candidate for the best of all time, The Temptations. It's a 5-CD set called Emperors of Soul, and it really lets you hear how the Temps reinvented themselves over and over again for more than 20 years. Sure, there's the rasp of David Ruffin and the sigh of Eddie Kendricks, but The Temptations emerge as an entity that overshadows even its most gifted lead singers. You get the doo-wop Temptations, the Smokey Robinson Temptations, the Norman Whitfield Temptations, the Temptations of a Thousand Faces in the 80s. Most of the unreleased or unavailable on album tunes are as spiffy as the guy's suits. As they say about Super Bowl teams, so many weapons here. So many sturdy voices, tight arrangements, crisp musicians, savvy songs. Even if you think you know the Temptations, Emperors of Soul might amaze you. My second selection is a little trickier, a little less famous. The Los Angeles funk band called War had the world in its pocket in the early 1970s, top 10 hits and all. But War's albums have been hard to find for a long time. Fortunately, there has never been a richer presentation of their work than the 2-CD collection called Anthology 1970 to 1994, which draws on all their phases and labels. War began as a backup group for, of all people, Eric Burdon, the guy who once sang House of the Rising Sun with the Animals. On Anthology, you can hear how the group kept Burdon's impassioned idealism but dropped his histrionics. They became a potent groove unit that could mix encouragement and biting social criticism in the same song. Musically, they put together a still unequaled blend of Latin and African-American idioms that was sweet and steely. The song selections here are both inclusive and decisive. Although the recent numbers sound a bit redundant, they are as limber and sensuous as ever. For those who don't fear the funk, Anthology 1970 to 1994 can indeed provide all-day music.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Music is what we like to play.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Irish actor and producer Gabriel Byrne. He played a gangster in the Coen Brothers film Miller's Crossing. Byrne produced In the Name of the Father. Now he co-stars in Little Women as the professor who Joe falls in love with. Gabriel Byrne coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New York City authorities say 31 people have been hurt in an explosion aboard a subway car. New York police say an incendiary device blew up, critically injuring four of the victims. New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani says police have determined there was no second incendiary device on the train, as was first reported.
All of the packages and briefcases and other things that were left behind on the train, which were the subject of some concern that they might contain another device, have now been searched. There was no other device found. The case is under investigation. I want to caution everyone, as we always do in a situation like this, that facts change because as more and more people are interviewed, numbers tend to change, some of the observations tend to change as you learn more about it. And I want to emphasize that everyone in the city should remain very calm. The emergency response here was close to miraculous in terms of being able to get there on time.
Officials are beginning to restore service to nearby subway lines. They expect to reopen the affected station sometime this evening. Officials say they want to interview a man found near the scene who had burns on his hands. He's now being treated at a hospital. Former President Jimmy Carter says he's obtained agreements from the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian government to release all prisoners in their civil war. Carter says both sides will let the International Red Cross come in, inspect their prison camps, and inventory prisoners. Carter is stressing the ceasefire agreement he brokered on Tuesday between the Bosnian warring factions is only tentative. He says the whole thing can very easily fall apart. U.S. officials say Congressman Bill Richardson will leave North Korea tomorrow with the body of Chief Warrant Officer David Heilman. Heilman died last weekend when his helicopter was downed in North Korea. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports U.S. officials hope Heilman's surviving crewmate will be freed soon.
Richardson will cross the border at the truce village of Panmunjom tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. local time, carrying with him the remains of Airman David Heilman. Chief Warrant Officer Bobby Hall, the surviving crew member, is not expected to be with Richardson. He will not accompany him. And the timing of his release from his North Korean captors still is a mystery here. U.S. officials, however, are buoyed by the anticipated return of his fellow crew member and hope that Hall's repatriation is close behind.
NPR's Julie McCarthy. The New York City Council has voted to approve a smoking ban in most public places. The mayor is expected to approve the bill. It will prohibit smoking in restaurants that seat more than 35 people, in outdoor stadiums, and other public places. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow rose more than 34 points. This is NPR. President Clinton has announced the creation of a group of more than 100 enterprise zones and communities. These areas will get special help to create jobs and wealth. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
The Empowerment Zone and Enterprise Community designations will bring cash grants and tax breaks to over 100 communities to help encourage investment and economic development. President Clinton announced the recipients in a White House ceremony.
What we want to do is to empower people at the community level to make the most of their own lives by solving their problems and have the federal government be a support to them for a change and not a burden. That is what this is all about.
The program will spend about $3.5 billion over 10 years, with about $1.3 billion in direct cash grants made available during the next 2 years. Bill Small at the White House.
A published report says Chrysler is getting ready to make the biggest profit-sharing payout ever in the auto industry. The Detroit News reports Chrysler will pay its 60,000 hourly workers bonuses that average $7,500. The paper is quoting an unidentified United Auto Workers official who's close to the deal. 6 years ago today, Pan Am Flight 103 was blown out of the sky over Lockerbie, Scotland. Today, there's a new controversy. An advertisement in the Washington Post outlines a plan by the Arab League on where to try two Libyans accused in the attack. The ad was paid for by the Libyan Arab Mission in New York. Families of the victims are criticizing the ad. They want the suspects tried in the United States, Scotland, or England. The Arab League wants the suspects tried in a Scottish court, but it wants the court to convene in the Netherlands. Again, our top story, an incendiary device exploded in a New York City subway car today, injuring 31 people, four of them critically hurt. No one was killed. The scene is described as chaotic. The FBI has now joined the investigation. Now the incident's been linked to a bomb. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the big Christmas film releases this year is Little Women. It's the third movie version of Louisa May Alcott's novel about four sisters and their mother in mid-19th century New England. I think we may have done something politically incorrect here. From this classic girl's story, we managed to interview one of the male leads, Gabriel Byrne. He plays the older professor who falls in love with Jo, played by Winona Ryder. Although the professor is an Italian immigrant, Byrne himself is Irish. He started his acting career in Irish television and made his film debut in John Borman's Excalibur. He starred in the gangster film Miller's Crossing. He produced and starred in Into the West and was the executive producer of In the Name of the Father. Gabriel Byrne really wanted a part in Little Women. He told me why.
I wanted to do it because the book itself to me is an important book, and I had read it, or had it read to me when I was like 9 years old by my mother, who read the entire book to us before we went to bed at night time. So it had a very special kind of memory for me. And I also liked the idea of the character, who was a kind of shy, sensitive man, an immigrant who could barely speak English, who was poor, but who loved this woman and encouraged her, and but not in a patronizing, condescending way, but in a way that truly brought out her real self. That was interesting to me.
When your mother read you Little Women when you were young, did the story have a lot of resonance for you as a boy?
Yeah, well, you see, that was at the time before people had said that, you know, there are differences between... told me that there were differences between the way men and women view the world, and I loved these characters, and I loved the world that it evoked, because living in Ireland, the world of Concord, you know, Massachusetts, was on the one hand accessible because I understood what it's like to live in a small town like that, and on the other hand, it had a kind of a mystique about it because it was America, because it was far away, because it was another century. But I did fall in love with Beth, who, to my shock and horror, died halfway through the book. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, and it was a conversation between two eight-year-olds, and I told them that when I grew up I was going to marry somebody like Beth. How wrong I was.
Absolutely. So what are the books did you read when you were young that made a big impression on you?
The first book I read was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And I really wanted to live at the Admiral Benbow under that creaking sign, looking out for seafaring men with one leg. That was a magical book. And at that time, for in Ireland, I think possibly because of my mother and my grandmother, I was introduced to the classics there, you know. And I read, or they read to me, Oliver Twist and, you know, most of Dickens. I mean, I had read most of Dickens by the time I was 13 or 14. And I'm trying to get my son, who's five now, interested in that kind of world, but I'm up against the Power Rangers and those kind of characters. So I'm having a hard job trying to do that.
I guess there wasn't nearly as much competing for your attention when you were young.
No, there wasn't. It was a different world. It was a literate world, you know. It was a world where books were important. And I see that now that books are becoming less and less important to kids.
So what was the town like where you lived?
I lived in Dublin, which is a peculiar place because it's a city, but it's also a village. And I was brought up in the countryside. And in many ways, it was still the 1920s there. And it was a town where, as I said, everybody knew everybody else, where characters stood out, where there was a tremendous sense of community. And I think one of the reasons that Little Women is kind of, that people find it an interesting movie is because it evokes that world again, the world of community and neighborliness and basic, like, Christian kindness between people, you know.
But did you want to stay with that family, or did you want to, like, get out and get to a bigger world?
I actually wanted to become a priest, which I did actually, which I studied to be a priest for 4 years, because I wanted to, looking back on it now, I think it was some kind of a romantic escape from the world, not a desire to belong to the world.
Why did you want to escape?
I really don't know. Looking back on it now, I don't know why. But I found the idea of being away from the world seductive. I still do.
Did you feel you were called?
Yeah, well, the word vocation, the translation of the word vocare is to be called, and people told me that I had a vocation to the priesthood, you know, and I kind of believed it too. But, you know, the world of the theatre and the world of the priesthood is not that very different. They're both very theatrical occupations, I think.
They both have costumes?
Costumes, ritual, ceremony. The Catholic Church especially had it figured out a very long time ago. I mean, the confessional predates Freud by 2,000 years, and and also the concept of light and sound and incense and all. I think it's a very sensual kind of theatre, really.
Of course, there's something that's really different between, say, the seminary and the theatre. You never get out of character in the seminary. You got to stay in character all the time.
You got to be in character all the time. I wasn't too crazy about that part of it, really.
It must be, you were a young man, so you were going through, like, puberty and training in the seminary at the same time.
Looking back on it now, the education that we received in Ireland at that time was kind of repressive. It wasn't about the leading out or the bringing out of anything from within you and fulfilling your potential. It was actually the exact opposite. It was about repressing the real part of yourself, and that's something I find I feel slightly bitter about. You know, I've just had a book published which I wrote, which came out in Ireland last week, and it's about, a lot of it is about what it was like to grow up in Ireland in the 50s. And on the one hand, we kind of cherish the myth that it was an innocent, beautiful place, carefree. The reality is that it wasn't actually, and it was very repressive and Victorian in many ways.
Will that book be published in the United States?
It comes out here in May, yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Pictures in My Head.
My guest is Gabriel Byrne. He plays the professor in the new film Little Women. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gabriel Byrne, and he stars as the professor in Little Women. So when did acting start to interest you?
I didn't become an actor until I was quite old, I suppose, for this business. I was like 28 before I started, and I was a school teacher. And I was always interested in theatre and cinema always. In fact, I'd worked as a film critic of sorts for a newspaper in Dublin, and I never thought that I could actually make a living at it or you know, have it be a full time occupation for me. And I was doing a co-production at the school one day between the boys' school and the girls' school. I used to teach in the girls' school, and one of the kids got sick, and, you know, in typical, like, Mickey Rooney fashion, there was nobody to go on except me, and I went on, and somebody said to me, you know, you should think about doing this for a living. And I had been thinking about doing it for a living, and that's how I became an actor at the ancient age of 29.
Let me go back to the seminary for a moment. What got you out of the seminary?
I was expelled for smoking in the graveyard, which, you know, a friend of mine had cigarettes, and we used to go to the graveyard in the morning times after breakfast and smoke there. And we got away with it for about 4 months until one day, I remember, the priest came in and walked between the aisles, and he said, "Somebody's been smoking in this room. If he doesn't stand up now, etc., etc." So I stood up, and I was brought to the principal's office, and he told me that basically I was no longer being called. I was actually being sent home. So they sent me home, and in ignominy and disgrace, 4.5 years as a failed priest.
Did you expect to be praised for your honesty?
I did, yeah. Yeah.
How naive.
How naive. I should have just kept my mouth shut, and I probably could have continued to smoke.
Well, what did that do to your faith and to your sense of yourself?
I always envied people who had blind faith, who believed without question. And I never really had that kind of faith. It's taken me a very long time to get it back again. And now I believe in a different way. Yes, it did. But then again, I kind of took the blame on myself. I thought, well, I did something bad, I did something wrong, so therefore I deserve to be punished for it, you know. It's a very old, kind of predictable Catholic reaction.
So do you think they did you a favor, finally, and throwing you out of the seminary?
Maybe I did them a favor.
I had read you had also been seduced, was the word that was used in an article, seduced by somebody at the seminary, a priest maybe, or a teacher?
Not seduced, no. I wouldn't say that, but there was sort of some form of sexual abuse, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that you dealt with, or something that really hurt you?
It's many years ago now, and I didn't realize what was going on at the time. There was a kind of an acceptance of it among the kids there that it happened, and that there were certain people who were, were responsible for initiating it. But it was regarded as a fact of life, and there was nothing you could really do about it, and there was no big deal about it. So it happened, and when I think back on how that was accepted, covered up, silenced, and that makes me angry. But the truth is that it didn't do me any damage that I'm aware of.
In Miller's Crossing, the Coen brothers' gangster film, you played a gangster, but I really like the way you once described the character. You described him as a man who feels everything and shows nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave a great performance in that film, but I'm thinking of how hard it is to show that on screen, to show feeling everything but showing nothing.
I think that was the real challenge of the role, you know? And to me, it was the most difficult, the most complex role I've ever played. I mean, they just are brilliant writers. There are just not many screenwriters around like the Coens. And so the complexity of their writing had to be matched by the complexity of acting. But that's, if I was to aspire to anything as an actor, that's the kind of acting that I kind of really admire. I really admire understated actors, you know. People like, I don't know, Spencer Tracy, people like that. People who can suggest emotions without really showing you in vivid, over-the-top detail, you know. I tend to go for more understated stuff, and it's less spectacular, but to me, more interesting in the end.
My guest is Gabriel Byrne. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight I'll talk with Roger Cohen of the New York Times, who yesterday met with Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic in Pale. The Bosnian Serbs have an idea for dividing up that country and the city of Sarajevo that differs quite a bit from the peace plan that is currently on the table. Essentially, it would create a divided city of Sarajevo. There's been an explosion in a New York City subway. We'll have details of that. Edward Liston reports on the 106 communities around the country that have been awarded special grants for economic development. Also, new concerns about the safety of some widely used painkillers, over-the-counter medications containing acetaminophen.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is actor Gabriel Byrne. He plays the professor in the new film Little Women. Now, you've been doing some producing lately. You produced In the Name of the Father. How did you get the rights, and why did you want the rights to Jerry Conlon's story?
Well, I had produced a play in London about another six Irishmen who left their houses one morning to go to a funeral in Belfast and were put away for life. They were known as the Birmingham Six. And then the Guildford Four. So there was 10 Irish people who were just like taken off the streets, evidence totally fabricated against them, and they were just put away for life. And I like a lot of other people, I was galled by the injustice of this. It used to rage within me how, because these people were Irish and because the Irish, to a certain extent in England, are discriminated against, and because they needed some kind of a scapegoat for the IRA atrocities that were happening at the time, innocent people were put away. And I was on my way back to New York and I saw Jerry's book in a wire basket at the airport that said 50% off. And I took it out and I thought, God, you write your story to say how innocent you are and it ends up in a basket in the airport with 50% off with, you know, like trashy romance novels. And I took it out and I read it on the plane. And when I got off at the other end, I rang Jerry, and who happened to be in New York at that time, and asked him, had he ever thought about making a movie out of it? And he said he was going out to Hollywood. I said, please don't. Meet me before you go. And he gave me the rights to the book for a dollar.
Now, why would he give you the rights for a dollar?
I think because he knew the kind of movie that I wanted to make out of it, and I did not want him to go to Hollywood and to have it like trivialized, and basically I didn't want his story and the story of the other 10 men trivialized. I wanted people to be aware that the justice system that exists in Britain and in America is basically not a... We've all been led to believe that the cornerstone of any democracy is a perfect justice system, and that if you have... If you do right, you will be rewarded. If you do wrong, you will be punished. And this case proved, without a shadow of a doubt, that that's not the case. So what you're really examining there with this movie is the justice system. How fair is our justice system? And at the time when I was trying to raise the money for it in Hollywood, I read a little piece in the LA paper about two black guys who had been put away in Orange County for life and got out after 18 years because they found that the evidence was fabricated against them. And I thought to myself, this is a universal story. This goes on everywhere. So I became passionate about the book and about the story. And, of course, nobody wanted to make it. And one producer said to me, you know, you should stick to acting. You shouldn't try to be producing movies. And anyway, the movie ended up being nominated for 7 Academy Awards, and I think that people, there's a market out there for those kind of movies. I think that people are getting tired of the same old crap, you know, with people shooting at each other and sex scenes and car chases, and I'm bored to death by these movies. And as a producer, I want to try and make movies that I think make make some kind of a difference, you know.
Well, I really love the film. I'm wondering, though, when you, when Conlon sold you the rights to his story for a dollar, did he know your work? Did he have any reason in the world to think that you would actually be able to get the movie made?
Well, it, probably not. But I had produced another movie called Into the West, which is a children's movie, which I think, and a lot of other people think, is one of the best children's movies of recent times. I have no doubt that it is. It's a movie that doesn't condescend or talk down or, treat children in an exploitative or in a cynical way. So he had seen that, and he knew that my intentions were good, and that I was not going to. I told him I wasn't going to make a big budget movie. I told him I wasn't going to go. That I would rather not make the movie, which was absolutely true. Unless it was the kind of movie we really wanted to make.
Have you read Jerry Conlon's aunt's book, who feels she was very misrepresented in the film?
Mm-hmm, I have, yeah. I already knew of her for Viewpoint. Yeah. My own feeling is that was a mistake. It should never have happened. The facts of the case themselves should not have been interfered with, I think. I just feel that.
So you think that the facts were interfered with a little bit in the film?
Yes, I do.
So you agree with her on some level?
I do, yeah.
And you feel bad about that?
I do.
So is that something you lost control over, or you weren't aware of?
The director of the movie is ultimately the one who is responsible for what goes into the film. I disagreed with it. I thought the facts of the case were shocking and sensational enough without having to change anything. And I'm disappointed that they were. That's my own opinion 2 years after the event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for talking with us. Gabriel Byrne, he plays the professor in Little Women. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sue Spolin, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Cherie Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie Heavenly Creatures is based on the true story of two girls whose friendship culminated in murdering the mother of one of the girls. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from the filmmakers and we'll feature an interview with mystery writer Ann Perry. It was recently revealed that Perry was one of the girls convicted of murder. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.